Welcome to ESIPE's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to David Hennig. David is director of the UK Trade Policy Project here at ESIPE. He's one of Britain's leading experts on trade policy and regularly comments and writes about Brexit and the future of UK trade policy. He was previously a senior official at the Department for International Trade in the UK, and while there, he set up the UK Trade Forum, a source for informed views about trade policy. I'm going to talk to David about, well, Brexit. We can't avoid that. But we are more importantly going to talk about the future of UK trade policy and whether Britain is going to be a free trading nation after it has exited the European Union. David, welcome to ESIPE's Global Economy Podcast.
Thank you, Frederick.
So we are going to talk about trade policy in the UK after Brexit and what we can expect from a future trade agreement between the EU and the UK. But we are recording this interview after a week of drama in the House of Commons, and I think it's impossible to begin this conversation without taking stock of the politics of Brexit in Parliament. A few things that we have learned this week is that MPs don't want to leave on the terms of the withdrawal agreement because they have yet again rejected it by a pretty solid margin. We have also learned that MPs want to accept a no-deal exit and that they like to extend Article 50 and have more time for Brexit. Generally, the government seems to have moved from chaos to anarchy, and there is really no sign that government or opposition benches are moving towards a position where MPs will give clarity to what position they can accept. I don't know if this is actually possible because everything is so confused right now, but taking a step back from this week's events, would you say that we have learned anything new or witnessed a development that gives reasons to believe the UK will leave the EU this year?
Yes, I think we have learned something new this week. And what we learned was that actually MPs did not want to leave with no deal, and that the government responded to that and said, right, we will ask for an extension. That was significant. We saw a sudden change from the government. Instead of saying it is this deal or no deal, they suddenly said it is this deal or it is a delay, an extension to think about the future. And suddenly now we have a lot more clarity. So we are almost certainly not going to be leaving the EU at the end of March. We're almost certainly not going to be leaving with no deal. We will either be leaving at the end of June with the Prime Minister's deal, or there will be a delay of a reasonably substantial time period, probably a year, during which we will see if we can find alternate arrangements and the UK government will try to handle things in a better way. One other thing, it may look like anarchy from the outside, but there were some signs in the last couple of days that actually the UK government was coming back from the brink of lack of control, of doing things wrong. They actually did a couple of quite sensible things towards the end of the week, which made one think that perhaps we're coming back to sense, and the view from the outside that the UK has lost all senses, it's being badly governed, might actually turn out to be premature. So this might be the week we actually grew up as a negotiating country.
And what was it that the government did that, in your view, brought it back from the brink?
So after the defeat they had about ruling out no deal, they put forward a very sensible motion to the House of Commons to say either we will have a deal and we will leave at the end of June, or we will not have a deal and it will be a longer delay. This was actually entirely sensible, reasonable, and got rid of the idea at one stroke of the idea that we could pass a deal next week and be ready to leave the EU at the end of March, which a lot of people studying the subject had realised was not going to happen, but the government had never said so. So suddenly they recognised reality, and that was very positive. They also then, in the following day, said to MPs that if the deal was turned down, they would start to organise indicative votes of what MPs would like to see. This is something that I first suggested back in October, and it looks like this will now happen. It should have happened some time ago. But then if there is no deal, it will give MPs a chance to say, well, what would we like to see instead?
And what do you think MPs would like to see instead? I mean, there has been this, you know, conversation around future models for Brexit, where you have, on the one hand, those that wants to have a much more formalized integrative model already acknowledged in the withdrawal agreement. This, for instance, is something we have heard from the opposition benches. There are others that talk about sort of Norway solutions and EEA solutions, etc. Would you say that this week's developments, or what we have learned over the past couple of weeks, will be taking UK closer to a type of Brexit that is, you know, going to tie it much more closer to the EU than perhaps was envisioned in the withdrawal agreement?
There are two forces now coming up against each other, which is why I can't answer the question simply. So there is definitely a large group of MPs who would like a more defined path to what we can best describe as a softer Brexit. Now, this will be somewhere in the environs of the either Norway or a Switzerland-style relationship or a customs union. We're not quite sure where that might come out, exactly which lines might be drawn and how the EU would respond, but there's a large group of MPs who would like something of that type. Now, that must be set against another possibility, which is that if we go for a long extension, then it is possible that the Conservative Party will elect a new leader who has a much more Eurosceptic come no deal frame, because that is what the Conservative Party members would like to see. And so I think that debate, in the event of the current withdrawal agreement not passing through Parliament, that debate is still open. So it will either be a softer Brexit or it will be no deal at all. So in other words, I think that this is the last chance now for the PM's deal. Now it is either softer or much, much harder Brexit.
So final question, David, on the politics of Brexit and the developments that we've seen this week. Would you say that the idea of a second referendum has now been effectively ruled out as an alternative going forward?
I think it's very unlikely there will be a second referendum. Perhaps if we, in a year's time, still have no better idea where we're going to, perhaps there would be a move towards it. But I simply don't see the support in the UK for a second referendum. There is a view across the parties, really, that the first referendum should be implemented. I think that there's a lot of resistance to changing that. So I don't see a majority at the moment, but obviously politics can change quickly. But at the moment, I see very little prospect.
People I talk to in the UK seem over the last couple of months to have become so frustrated and sick and tired of the entire Brexit process that there is this, in my view, growing feeling that sort of they want to leave regardless of the consequences. I'm thinking about sort of what an extension, a long extension, actually would do to British politics and the entire issue about what form Brexit will take. So a long extension, as you were alluding to in your comment, David, would basically imply that at some point there's going to be a new election, that this parliament wasn't capable of finding a majority for any type of solution. So elect a new parliament and see if they can actually come to a conclusion on what type of Brexit that the country wants to have. You know, I know it's difficult to predict what a new election would result in, but I guess you would agree with me if I say that, well, on the Conservative side, it would probably lead to, in the first place, the deselection of many pro-EU remaining type of MPs, and that the Conservative Party is going to become much more of a hard Brexit party. On the Labour side, we're probably not going to find after the election that it will have greater clarity in what type of Brexit they'd like to see, or that they would have better resolve in actually trying to bring its MPs in support of any type of clear motion, whether that would be a second referendum or leaving on the terms of withdrawal agreement. So is there anything that could be helped, sort of that could be helped, or anything that could be resolved by dissolving this parliament and electing a new parliament?
I don't think it would be very helpful. I think it may happen, but I don't think it would be very helpful to UK discussions of Brexit to have another election. I think the parties are split on the EU. The parties have been split on the issue of Europe for 50 years. I don't think they're going to be unsplit. And I think that what UK politics has to do is to recognise that there are some issues that cut across party lines. This is one of them. And to find the consensus within those splits. In that, if there is a general election, yes, you could expect to see slightly different composition. Would the EU be an issue in a general election. Because I think if I was the Labour Party, I think I would campaign on everything but the EU and say that the Conservatives are obsessed and we will deliver everything else for the country. So, and I think the Conservatives are scared that that would exactly be the message and that it would be a very popular one. So I think that general election, although it gets a lot of excitable talk, is probably not the answer either. The answer would seem to me still to lie within Parliament trying to come together and finding the terms of withdrawal and a future relationship that command broad consensus. And the current Parliament is as well placed as any to find that solution, but it will take them a little time and it will take a different style of leadership than we have seen so far.
Now, David, let's leave the politics of Brexit for a moment and start to talk a little bit about what is going to happen in the next steps when we get to the point where the UK and the EU will begin to negotiate its longer term relation, looking at trade policy and what type of trade relations that they're going to have. So from your perspective, how would you describe that the main alternative? What are they looking like?
So I don't think there's been that much thinking among governments as to the kind of relationship that the UK and the EU should have in terms of trade in the future. So it's given a shorthand of Switzerland or Norway, but the UK is a much more significant economy, and one would think that whatever the starting point, this relationship has to be to some extent bespoke. It has to suit the UK and the EU. Thus, for example, I find it hard to believe that any existing EU relationship quite covers the fact that London has one of the world's largest financial centres, and it's also a crucial financial centre for the EU. Now, that has to be taken account of, and I don't think it has been in thinking so far. So I think it needs to be, to an extent, bespoke. It clearly depends on the level to which the UK is wanting to commit to certain things like freedom of movement. So far, that's a red line for the UK. Will that change? We would have to see. What does the UK want in trade policy? And we know that those things will have implications. But also on the EU side, is the EU offering the UK a privileged partnership of some sort? There's clearly a lot of, is anger the right word, bitterness about the UK leaving the EU. And some people want to say that the UK can't be seen to succeed as a result of this. Does that mean that the EU does not, in fact, want to give the UK a privileged position? Hopefully, they will decide that actually, no, it is in everybody's interest to do so. But that seems to me to be a long negotiation to come, where both sides think, what is really in our interests? What is really in the interests of our businesses? And what makes sense between us in terms of a relationship?
How important will it be for the UK to have an independent trade policy as a consequence of Brexit? I'm asking because, at least in the British debate, there is this view that if you have a relationship with the EU, which includes a customs union, or perhaps even a bespoke type of relation that brings it closer to a type of EEA arrangement, that would effectively destroy the chances of the UK to have an independent trade policy in the future and be able to negotiate with other countries. So how do you reckon, what's the importance of the role of an independent trade policy in the UK for the future?
Right now, the UK debate puts trade policy in a position where it's seen as really important. We must have a trade policy. But that's without thinking too much about what that trade policy means, what it will actually be able to generate for the country. And obviously, actually, there's a spectrum here. Customs union, you don't have control over tariffs, but you do over services. In the EEA, you wouldn't have control over regulations, but you could potentially have control over tariffs and do trade deals as Norway does. So I think it will need the UK to be a little bit more sophisticated and the UK government to make this case. What is it we actually want to do? Now, currently, the UK trade policy debate of the last few weeks has seen a US trade deal be discussed quite extensively and in quite negative terms. Now, a US trade deal would require the UK not to be in a customs union or in the EEA, effectively, but it's far from clear that a US trade deal would have majority of public support or parliamentary support. There are already articles being written in opposition to it from Conservative MPs, among others. So that might turn out to not be so important. So if a US trade deal is not so important, perhaps we can have trade deals while still being in the Norway option. I think that would be seen as a strong possible option. Or if we thought that services was really important, then does it really matter so much if we're in a customs union? Perhaps we can find a new way of doing services-only trade agreements, which has long been a problem area in the global trade system. But what if we did trade agreements? We tried to create a new open access services agreement with a few like-minded countries, a kind of trade and services agreement light, and try to expand it. Is that an option? So I think there's a lot of options here for UK trade policy, whatever the relationship is with the EU, and these need to be set against each other. And I think that's the debate that's just starting in the UK and will be quite a big debate in the coming weeks and months.
Are you confident that UK trade policy after Brexit will conform to at least the legend of UK trade policy, which is that the country is a free trading country, always has been, and given a choice between more openness or status quo, it's always going to choose more openness? I'm asking the question because my impression is that the trade policy compact in the UK, just as in many other Western countries, is beginning to crumble, and that you'll find that the strong consensus that existed before on the benefits of open trade isn't as strong as it were before. If you look, for instance, at the Labour side, it's quite clear that at least it has a leadership right now in the party which doesn't really believe in the concept of free trade. When you look at the Conservative side, you will see not just that you have more MPs that are critical of the type of flows that we see in modern trade, for instance, that you have labor moving across border in order to deliver services. But you can also see in the broader discussion, for instance, on tariffs on agricultural products, that there is a growing sentiment among Conservative MPs that British agriculture needs to be protected. It needs to rely much more on domestic food supply, etc. So will that all free trade compact really stand after Brexit?
No. I'm going to give a longer answer than that, clearly, to a longer question. So I think that initially we see after 2016, the referendum, the new Department for International Trade and the Secretary of State, Liam Fox, almost thinking that the case for trade has been made, almost coming into this as if TTIP and TPP and the debates around those had never happened, and assuming that the UK would be more liberal and that it was just a matter of time. And then we're going to see a little bit of reality coming in. It comes in over discussions about a potential trade deal with the US. That has been rumbling around for a couple of years. But it also comes in with the fact that domestic interest groups that we know well from trade policy around the world tend to get organized and quite protectionist, like the farming lobby. We see that they're among the first to get up and running and to say, no, well, we need protections. We see this week an announcement of provisional tariffs that the UK would apply in the case of a no-deal Brexit. And it's very interesting to see what is protected. They are broadly liberalizing. There's a lot of industrial tariff lines that are currently between 0 and 5% that would be removed. But we see the car industry, for example, car tariffs being maintained, even though most of our cars are imported from the EU. Most of the cars we make in the UK are exported. So that would put up prices. We see agriculture protected, particularly in some sectors. But then again, we see other sectors less so. So it was quite an interesting balance. But once we go into a longer debate, you can expect some of those interests got a little bit of a shock in seeing that tariffs would have been removed and are starting to fight back. We can expect as well on the regulatory side that there will be a certain amount of protectionism. And I don't think the case has been made at all in the UK that it is important to be on the liberal side. I think we will broadly be on the liberal side, but I think we will have the same battles that every other country has been having about trade. It kind of comes with the territory right now. And I think that case has to be made again in the UK. This is why trade will be important to us. These are the kind of products. And also, we need to find a vision for what the trade will be. What will be a popular trade policy for the UK? And it's not clear at the moment, and that will have to be bound into industrial strategy as well. It's not clear what all of this will amount to. So I think there's a lot of work ahead to overcome that challenge and many related challenges.
Let's assume that Britain is going to leave the EU this year, and that in 2 years' time the transition period will end, and at that point Britain will start to negotiate new trade deals around the world. So we've already talked about the EU as being clearly one of the first priorities for UK trade policy, getting to a trade agreement with the EU. The second issue we talked about is the United States, and we are not entirely sure where that idea is going. What does the rest of the list of prioritized UK trade deals look like? Are there other countries on that list with whom the UK likes to do bilateral deals? And if so, which are those countries?
So on the formal list from the UK government, the countries are Australia, New Zealand, and also accession to the CPTPP, Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's the formal list. Australia and New Zealand, obviously, they will have strong agricultural interests, and that might be bound up a little bit in what happens at the WTO, where our schedules have yet to be agreed, in particular those for agricultural quotas. CPTPP brings some of the same issues as with the US in terms of some of the standards issues that may not be compatible with EU, a close relationship with the EU. What's interesting in that list is that actually, of course, the existing EU trade agreements are not in there, and that assumes that the UK has managed to replicate existing EU trade agreements, and in fact, it may not have done. So a couple of countries in particular that may well have to be added to the list are Turkey, where the nature of the EU Customs Union makes it very difficult to roll that over, and a lot will depend on our EU relationship, and Japan, who have expressed strong reservations about rolling over the existing EU-Japan agreement and would like to make some changes. So they could well be added to the agreement. We may also see that Canada and Korea will want to make changes to their agreements. So suddenly you have a much larger agenda than just Australia and New Zealand, and some more thought will need to be given to prioritization. And also, those are just for the free trade agreements. Will the UK be trying to do smaller agreements, mutual recognition agreements, or similar with other economies? And we may well see many of those. So there's a lot more work to be done. And I think as well for other countries, what if they make the UK an offer and say, what if China said, actually, we do want an FTA? We could negotiate, and we could give you a really good FTA, negotiate it with us instead of, I don't know, the US. It would be interesting to see what would happen to UK priorities in that situation.
Yeah, because that was what I was going to ask. In that list, there are two notable exceptions, China and India. And if you listen to at least some of the views that come from the Brexit side, one of the arguments for leaving the EU was basically that the UK would be free to strike new free trade deals with the growing economies in the world, like, for instance, China and India. What's the thinking behind China and India not being on that list? Is there a sequence in the way that the UK thinks about its future trade policy, where it first wants to do free trade deals with countries like Australia and New Zealand that can be very comprehensive deals, and then you're going to use that as a benchmark or a model for negotiating with other countries? Or do you think that the UK is going to be much more opportunistic in what type of free trade deals it wants to have, sometimes doing what in the EU parlor is called deep and comprehensive free trade agreements, and on other occasions it may be willing to do trade deals that are going to be very shallow, but at least it's going to give them something?
So it's not clear that there is a lot of thinking that sits behind that initial choice of countries, and certainly nothing that has been published. So there is no published trade strategy which says this is why it's these countries and not these other countries. China is certainly of interest, but obviously there's a bit of a clash between a China deal and a US deal, given the nature of US-China relations at the moment and the provisions in USMCA about trade agreements with non-market economies. India would give the UK a problem in terms of India's long stated ambition to include a lot of Mode 4 provision in there. And an India trade agreement would be difficult. One could add on to that Mercosur. Would the UK have as much difficulty as the EU in doing a trade agreement with Mercosur? What about the Gulf, where lots of UK politicians spend lots of time, but is there really the market in the Gulf, and could the Gulf come up with this kind of free trade agreement? Like India, they don't find it easy to do trade agreements due to their own internal politics. But there's no necessary logic with this. Certainly, New Zealand and Australia are seen as areas where we could get a model trade agreement from them, but they won't be terribly easy either, but given the Australia has an interest not just in agriculture but in visas as well. We're not quite sure what other interests New Zealand may have apart from agriculture. So there's a lot of challenges ahead, and not completely clear what the rationale is and whether it might need to be changed. So I think that what we would want to see would be the government sharing more information about why it's chosen those markets. And there is a view among business in the UK that actually this is too conservative with a small c, that actually if you're going to do Brexit, you should think much bigger. And China would be an example of thinking much bigger. Let's do a trade deal with China. Let's try to get a better deal on services than anybody has ever got from China before. And that would be something genuinely innovative in world trade rather than what looks like quite a cautious approach.
If you take a long view on UK international economic policy, you will see that this is a country that has been investing quite a lot in multilateral or international organizations like the World Trade Organization and the OECD. What type of thinking exists among officials, government people right now in the UK in terms of how they want to use membership in those organizations to put forward a British view on what they'd like to see happening, either in global trade negotiations or in work at the OECD that relates, for instance, to issues around state subsidies, competition policy, and many other issues that have caused a lot of friction in the world economy over the last years?
So, frankly, not a huge amount. Brexit has taken up most of the energy of the last 2 to 3 years. Now, if we go to the period before Brexit, the UK had a strong interest in pushing what they called the rules-based international economic system, which had quite a focus on, for example, the OECD and things like state subsidies and global rules. That has tailed off to a degree in terms of interest, but you could expect a little bit more interest there, maybe not as much, because that was something we could do as a member of the EU and still push independently, was that idea of global rules of the road. What will be for the UK of more or of greater priority will be whether we have new ability at the WTO to make things happen there. That's probably asking quite a lot to the UK to have influence at the WTO, given where we are with the WTO. But that's the ambition that ministers have stated, is to say we want to be leaders for trade liberalisation at the WTO. We want to support the e-commerce plurilateral and trying to make it happen. We want to try to revive the trade and services agreement, though that will be very tough. We want to see what else is possible. So I think there will be more emphasis on the WTO. I think that will start from the moment of Brexit. But obviously, as we know from that organisation, it's difficult to affect change. And I'm not sure there will be quite as much attention to the OECD and the global rules agenda as there has been in the past.
We are getting close to the end now, David, but there's one final question that I'd like to ask you. And this, of course, is something that you've also written about. So even after Brexit, when you look at UK trade policy, looking at what type of leadership that it can offer globally or regionally, one thing that is staring you in the face is that many of the allies that it wants to have will still be in Europe, not necessarily the EU always, but other countries in Europe that are members of the EU and that like to see much more emphasis on a rules-based international trade order, like to see much more global rules on issues like intellectual property, state aid, and those issues that we just talked about. So how would you, in the first place, characterize the type of work that the British government is doing right now in maintaining close ties to its European allies? And in the second place, what would you advise them to do if they aren't doing it already?
So, yes, I mean, the UK had exceptionally strong relations in recent years with the likes of Ireland, the Netherlands, Sweden, Finland, Denmark, the Baltic countries. And these have been strained, there's no doubt, in the last couple of years, because the UK has been seen to be more transactional in its approach. We're no longer speaking up for that agenda so much in the EU, and won't be at all very soon. And at the same time, many of our conversations with them have been about how they can help us with Brexit, not about how we can retain this sort of relationship. So what we really need to see going forward is, if you like, the return of UK diplomacy, of carefully building up these relationships again. I've had a lot of conversations with people from Sweden, Ireland, the Netherlands, to name but three, and there is a lot of interest. They're very happy to try to rebuild relations, to find ways to work together in the future, but all of them are waiting for, to a degree, for a little bit of a steer from the UK, to for the UK to be ready and to say, right, these are the sort of things we want to put in place, these are the sort of dialogues we're going to have, and we're not doing this for any specific reason, like please support us in this vote. We're doing it because it's the right thing to do, and we still want to be close friends and allies. There hasn't been much talk in the UK about close friends and allies. So I think, as well as at the diplomatic level, I think that the Foreign Office would be hoping to persuade ministers there to speak more publicly about the need for friends and allies in the future, and to change the narrative from what can seem to be a isolated UK one in the UK to one of, no, we have many friends. Some of them are in Europe, some of them are around the world, and we continue to work with those friends in pursuit of our global trade agenda. So that there's a lot that needs to happen there. It isn't really happening yet, but perhaps once Brexit gets a little bit more settled, which is where we came in, then also the UK will be able to pick up some of those relationships again and realize that they have been a little bit tense in the last couple of years, and there is a need now to work harder, rebuild those friendships, so that the UK is maybe not in the EU, but still has many friends in the EU.
All right. Thank you so much, David. It's been a great pleasure talking to you. And also thank you so much for helping us to understand not just what happened in the UK this week what may happen in the next coming weeks as far as the withdrawal agreement is concerned, but also for helping us to put light on the future of UK trade policy. Thank you, and bye-bye.
Thank you.